This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify. Welcome to the Deep Dives podcast here on the No Ceilings NBA podcast feed. I'm your host, Nick Agar-Johnson, and I am incredibly excited about today's episode. Finally, someone else at No Ceilings wrote a wonderful feature-length piece about one of my favorite draft prospects for 3 years running now. So I'm here today to talk with Rowan Kent about, if you're Stephen and listening to this at 4 a.m. on Wednesday morning, the upcoming article. If you're everybody else listening to this, the article going up today on NoCeilingsNBA.com about Daron Holmes from Rowan Kent. Rowan, how are you doing this fine afternoon?
I'm doing great. Now that you've stopped blowing up my phone asking if we can do the episode, I'm
ready. See, I do apologize for the 473 unread text messages. It was a bit much, but I mean, we're talking about Daron Holmes, so I couldn't resist.
Yeah.
So just a quick note for all of you in case something happens drastically in the next 48 hours. We are recording on Monday before the NCAA championship game. So if Daron Holmes secretly subs in off the bench for Purdue, then you'll know that we did not know of that before this happened. Not that there's any chance of that happening. Anyway, so as I said and have said for literally years now for anybody who's been following this podcast / my work at No Ceilings, Daron Holmes has been one of my favorite draft prospects for a while, but it's nice to have somebody else who's been on the bandwagon and now is, you know, officially written a feature about him. So I want to start there. I did love your intro for this piece, so I'm going to let you go into it as much as you want, but what was it that led you to write about Daron Holmes for this piece?
I think there are two sides to what led me to write about Holmes and to really want to. It starts even before. I was writing for No Ceilings last year when I would see, or rather not see, Daron Holmes' name on a lot of boards across a whole range of different sites. I would wonder why. I would see him play and I would feel like I was seeing talent or a kind of player that would make a lot of sense in the first round. Obviously, the top of last draft was figured out very quickly, but it was a guy who really screamed first round to me, so he chose to come back. There were even little buzz elements of would he look at other schools. There were rumors. I think other college teams wanted him to transfer if he was coming back, and so that's where a lot of the rumors from fan bases came from. But he returned to Dayton and got to really step into the biggest star role that he could. But then on the other side, I tend to have larger fixations on different hobbies in my life. Basketball's been the longest lasting. And even with, like, prospects, now that's about 2 years running with Holmes, it's one where I've really enjoyed looking at his game, seeing how it gets better and better. And it was about time. It was about time that I dove deeper into his film, that I could really crunch the numbers. And I'm coming away with the same conclusion that he should be a first round guy in my mind.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I wrote about him very early last season. So essentially, there were, I think, like 6 games, if I'm remembering correctly, that he'd played in his sophomore campaign. But almost all of what I was writing about, of course, was his freshman season at Dayton. And you know, it was interesting that I wrote about him then and you're writing about him now, just purely in the sense that his role at Dayton, you know, his sophomore and junior year has looked drastically different from when it did his freshman year. And it's been fascinating to sort of think, you know, I was thinking of him as a first round pick based on what he did during his freshman season, which essentially was just be hyper efficient at everything you could want, you know, more of a role player type to do. And basically, since I wrote that article, he's been the hub of the Dayton offense. And, you know, that's come with Tumani Kamara, who was a second round pick last year, but, you know, has essentially become a starter for the Phoenix Suns, being his running mate, and him not even being the guy that I thought was the best prospect on the Dayton team. And it's been fascinating to see sort of the evolution of the perception of Daron Holmes as he's morphed into a completely different role than the one he was so successful in his freshman year.
With other college basketball teams, you see like the importance of continuity. Like the teams that are winning the past few years have actual continuity. They're not just doing the revolving door of transfers. We can see with a prospect like Holmes who comes back to the same school. Now in his third year, you get to see the trust that the coaching staff was putting in, the actual belief and the deep understanding of like where he should get touches, how many touches he should get in each area, what they know he can do in practice, and then letting him try that in games. There were a lot of things that, compared to watching Holmes last year to this year, even though he had that same role as being the main guy to score on this Flyers team, there are things this year that like piqued my interest. I was like, if he can work on that to another level that really makes his way into his bag, like what can he be outside of? And that's what was really exciting about seeing it from Holmes is I liked him last year. You, in the same way, have liked him since his freshman year. He continues to get better, and he gets better in ways that will get him onto the floor once he's playing NBA minutes.
That latter part is, I think, really the most important point to hammer home is it's not just that he's been getting better, right? I mean, you know... Development isn't linear. We talk about that all the time. You know, some players, regardless of how great their work ethic is, you know, improve at different rates just because, hey, this isn't a science, right? There's a reason that, you know, there are draft steals and draft busts every single year is because it's not an exact science. You don't know who's going to do what when they come into an NBA environment. You don't know who's going to do what on each team. I mean, you can think throughout history of all the obvious examples of players who, if they'd been drafted to a different team, they wouldn't be anywhere near the star they are, or guys who, if only they weren't drafted by the worst possible team to draft them, maybe would have been something different. But the key here, I think, is it's not just that Holmes has been improving. It's that Holmes has been improving in very specific ways that will make it easier for him to get onto an NBA floor. So why don't we sort of start with the overview here, and we'll go into the section that, as you mentioned, Daron Holmes II in his optimal prime. So this year, what we've seen from Holmes has been, you know, a step forward in many ways since last season. But, you know, there's a way that a guy could take a step forward. Like if Holmes had taken a step forward because he was shooting out of the post 15 times a game and hitting 9 of them, it would be very different from, you know, his NBA projection as opposed to the ways that he has actually taken tangential steps forward this year. It's not just, oh, okay, if you feed him the ball in the post 20 times a game, he's going to be a valuable scorer in a way that would be a lot harder to envision in the NBA, right? It's, okay, he's shown improvement in specific areas that makes his rotation fit much easier to project.
Yeah, and some of those areas, like, already as a scorer, and we'll get into his shooting, like, on the inside, as you're talking about, if he was getting those post-ups, Dayton would be doing well. Their offense would be getting efficient shots. He has a really well-developed post game, but it's those other places where he maybe had showed a flash, but now is pushing himself with his passing. It always been a little bit of a, like a tease, and now he was someone who is really whipping those out of his post touches, getting to the line almost 9 times a game. That's going to go down with his usage, but it's, in general, the ability to keep working through contact, to keep getting the easier touches, that is an encouraging thing. And yeah, overall, like, I don't think he'll be as good at patrolling a passing lane as he will be on the inside on defense. It's the same kind of slow incremental step up that we've seen in his game that at least makes you wonder, what if he keeps up this pace? What could he be outside of the role we can see for him?
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's interesting because that was sort of my original thought on Holmes is, man, he's, you know, someone who could make sense as a backup big a lot of places. And as his game has evolved, you know, it's evolved in a very interesting way towards, okay, he's become the guy for Dayton. But I think, you know, maybe this is just me having had a very rosy outlook on him for a very long time. But I think there's an element to which, ironically enough, his sort of monopolization is not fair, but, you know, his massive role in the Dayton offense might sort of detract from, you know, people's view of what's going to be most important for him in the NBA, which is his secondary skills. And, you know, I don't have the numbers up in front of me right now, but, you know, his freshman year, he was ridiculously efficient at basically every complementary play type. And he's had fewer of those as the years have gone on, but it's not because he's gotten worse at those things. It's because he's had a bigger role in the offense. And so, you know, if you're looking at it as, oh, you know, this guy who's always posting up for Dayton, always has the ball in his hands, like, you know, what's he going to do when that doesn't happen at the next level? He's already shown that he can be excellent at those complementary skills. It's just been a couple of years.
Exactly. And it's not in the case of he's expanded or really drastically changed his game so that he wouldn't be able to be like just a putback demon, or he wouldn't be setting like screens and doing that. Those are the places that maybe he goes back towards that square one, you know, when he's in a league full of adults and the best professionals, but it's because he's mastered those skills. He's been building on the skills he's mastered, expanding his bag, as you were, of all of the different places on offense, on defense. And so what he was great at as a freshman, he's still going to be great at as a rookie when he's playing.
So let's go into some of those details that you mentioned in the piece and sort of start with the most obvious to see elite area for him. And that is that he's been and continues to be one of the most prolific dunkers in college basketball.
Yeah. And there were, I tried to find like, oh, would it be this kind of play type? Would it just be rolling to the rim? Would it be, I think sometimes if you look at high dunk attempts, high dunk makes, you wonder how much comes in transition. The looks are either well created out of a pick and roll setting, they're well created out of the post, or he's starting to drive and actually just cauterize, posterize, vaporize anyone in his way. It really helps that he has plus length for a center. He has the mobility to get around guys, and he doesn't take it soft. He will want to just slam. And sure, the numbers are slightly lower. It goes back to our point of he's been changing what he's doing with his role. He is still like averaging a bunch, like 73 dunks compared to 83 or 89. Those numbers, why can't he be dunking off of better passing, better spacing at the next level?
That, I think, is the key element here. I mean, we'll get into his projections at length later on because I'm not going to be able to shut up when talking about that. But, you know, just purely in terms of looking at where his role will be in the NBA as a rookie, right? You know, if he were someone who was going to be a starter right away, we would be talking about him as more than a first round pick, right? We'd be talking about him as a top five pick. So when you sort of keep that element of it in mind, then you look at his game and think, okay, so what's it going to look like when he's not, you know, the dramatic focus of the defense's attention, right? And I mean, you know, with Dayton, of course, you have to pay attention to Kobe Brea because he's one of the best shooters in college basketball. And, you know, last year, Tumani Kamara was around. You know, they don't quite have another sort of clear NBA level prospect other than Holmes like they did with Kamara last season. But even last season with Kamara in the fold, you know, Kamara was essentially playing a complimentary role on offense just like he has been this season, except, you know, he's been doing it around Holmes. And the, you know, idea there, I think, is with Holmes, all of what you're seeing, you know, other than if you go back and look at his freshman year tape, which, you know, not something I haven't done, but and other than that, he's been the focus of the offense, right? And so the idea is all those lanes that he has to fight through, he's not going to have to fight through to the same extent because he's not going to be the focus of the defensive attention, right? And so then the question becomes, okay, you know, maybe he's not averaging, you know, however many post-ups a game, but when he's trying to get to the lane, which he will do, and he will do with force, as you said, there aren't going to be, you know, there's not going to be the focus of the defense in his way like there has been for the last two college seasons.
Yeah, and the way he is going to get himself the easy looks on the inside is like he is a a good screener. He knows how to get into position. I think like the best screeners, they really do like clobber you. He's probably a step down from like a top tier screening prospect. Would be really fun to look back in retrospect at who those people would be, but he is up there. And what he can do versatility wise off of that is what makes like his floor and what the minutes he'll be getting in that role like very appealing without it getting all those touches. He can get to the rim. He showed a lot of just popping out very fluidly. It did not look stunted. It did not look awkward. Being able to extend his range like that. And obviously, if he had taken more shots before, that would be great. But he was taking a lot of pick and pop threes. And that kind of weapon, that gets you on an NBA floor. That forces defenses to just play a little bit closer to you. His screening can open up whoever is handling the ball in that offense. Even without him like touching the ball, the threat of what he does off of a screen is going to make an impact.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Let's actually get into that versatility and that sort of pick and pop stuff right now, because the biggest difference by far in Daron Holmes's game from when I wrote about him early last year to when you're writing about him now is he's added the three-point shot to his game in a way that it was literally not a part of his game at all before that. I mean, his freshman year, he took a grand total of 7 3-pointers, 7, hit one of them. Last year, you know, he upped his volume to a grand total of 19 three-pointers, and he hit 6 of them. So, okay, you know, improvement. I mean, I've said so many times that people have gotten sick of it. I'm sure that, you know, I refer to myself as a quote-unquote partial free-throw truther. And as you mentioned later in the piece, there is clear evidence that Holmes has shown improved touch just purely if you look at his free-throw numbers, you know, which, again, going from 59% as a freshman to 67% last year to 71% this year, you know, he's gone from troubling free throw shooter to right around average, which I think is a huge positive indicator of his touch. But, you know, again, there's an element to which, you know, taking half a three-pointer a game versus 2.5 per game, I mean, you know, there's the obvious sort of math of, oh, wow, he's taking, you know, 4 times as many as he did last year. Fantastic, right? But the idea of it is just making him all that much more versatile, as you were talking about earlier, right? He's not just your typical screen and roll big, right? He's added this element to his game that makes it easier to fit him into a whole lot of NBA lineup constructions, right? If you think about virtually all NBA offenses will, you know, at least have 3, usually 4 players who are out, right? Like 4 out, 1 in is usually the way it goes. And if you're the 1 in, you know, and it's been an interesting trend to see teams who, you know, employ non-shooting guards in that quote unquote in role and sort of an inversion of what you think of as traditional offense. But that's a different concept than if you're the 1 in guy, you have to cover a lot of bases. And the good news for Holmes is that he already covered a lot of bases, even if he was going to be the 1 in guy. But you're talking about a completely different player if you're adding that pop spacing element, as opposed to just, okay, we have to surround this guy with shooters because he's going to be the only guy who can't shoot. Now it's, all right, there are a lot more different contexts that are interesting with him involved if you don't have to necessarily think of him as the guy who has to be in the paint and around the basket.
Yeah, it opens up so much for him. He's covering the right bases already with what he does. And we talked about it when I was on deep dives when we were talking about Dylan Jones. When you see a spike in attempts and a spike in percentage, it's worth pumping at least a little bit of the brakes to think about, is this a hot streak? A season-long hot streak is the best sort of place to look of, is this actual development? The fact that he was taking 2.5 threes a game, like he had put in the work before, he's showing the confidence to take those. And so I don't believe that right off the bat, he'll be a 38.6% three-point shooter in the NBA. that would elevate him not only in terms of being one of the people who could be out in an offense, but like someone you'd really need to close out on in like a very high tier of NBA big men. But if he's even a little bit below that, he is making plays that defenses have to respect. Whatever team that's drafted him can really switch up the geometry of their offense. And in the way of you're talking about, whoever that non-shooter is, that player is probably good at so many other things that Holmes, by being a good shooter, is helping to raise the floor of the lineups he's in. It opens up a lot for him. I want to see him keep shooting. I'm sure teams will get him in the gym for private workouts, will ask him to keep shooting. They'll want to see it too. But if he does, eventually I think he can get back to this 38% mark, and that is just really a great number for the player archetype that he'll fill.
Yeah, and for me, you know, I think a huge part of it is it's not just that he's started shooting, it's that he's started shooting in a way that will directly translate to the kind of shooting he'll be asked to do at the NBA level, right? He's not taking 30-foot pull-up jumpers off the dribble, but he's in the 92nd percentile as a spot-up shooter this year. That is so huge for, you know, the way that his game is going to play out, because again, his three-pointers are not going to be, he's got the ball in his hands, you know, he's stepping back into a 25-footer. It's okay, you know, he just set the screen, point guard is driving to the basket, and he's got two men on him, he throws the ball out to Holmes, you know, at the top of the key, and Holmes steps into a three and knocks it down, right? That's what he's going to be doing as a shooter at the next level. And you know, even just compared to his sophomore season, right, where he shot occasionally, but, you know, again, 19 three-pointers total is not exactly a very reliable sample size. But, I mean, last year he was, so this is all per synergy, last year he was in the 49th percentile as a spot-up shooter, and it was essentially his least common play. I mean, the only play below it in terms of frequency is miscellaneous, right, which is basically just everything that doesn't have a clear synergy category. Okay, fine, right? This year, you know, it's not like he's shooting seven times a game from distance all of a sudden, but it's become a part of his game. It's become something that he's incorporated that, okay, when a defense, you know, strands him at the top of the three-point line, you know, he's going to be able to shoot, and he's going to be willing to shoot, and he's going to be able to hit them at a decent rate. And, you know, it's funny because you talk in the piece about sort of the speed of his release. One of the problems that I had with evaluating his tape when I did was how slow his shot looked, how much time he had to get, how much space he had before he'd be willing to let it fly on, you know, again, one of the seven times he did his freshman year, one of the, I think at the point I'd written the piece, he'd taken like two or three triples and hit one of them. It was like, okay, you know, in theory, this is something that maybe could happen down the line, but not exactly going to buy in on this being a part of his game. And, you know, there's always the downside element. I've called it the Derek Williams principle because, you know, a huge part of Derek Williams's draft stock was, you know, that one year where he hit like 50% of his three pointers on the 70 that he took and was never anywhere near that caliber of shooter in the NBA. You know, yes, as you mentioned, there's an element of we have to be at least a little bit skeptical of someone who doesn't shoot becoming a shooter out of nowhere. But all the developmental trends with his free throws, you know, the way that he's clearly reworked his shot, just visually looking at it this year compared to previous years, you know, there's a lot of reason for doubt, as there is with any of these sort of three-point explosions, but there's also a lot of room for hope, I think, in a way that isn't necessarily always the case with this, because he's taking the kind of shots that he would take at the NBA level. He's hitting them at a decent rate. He looks relatively comfortable with it. And, you know, it's not the kind of insane, like 50% shooting where people are going to expect, oh, he's going to come in, as you said, right? He's not going to come in and be a 38% three-point shooter, almost certainly. But the shots he's taking, the way that he's taking them, makes it very easy, at least for me, to project, okay, you know, he's not a pure stretch shooter, right? He's not just only going to play for the shooting element, but I have reason to believe that the shooting is at least somewhat real in a way that isn't necessarily the case with guys who have three-point explosions out of nowhere.
I don't consider myself like any kind of eye test truther, but the way you brought up, like, he looks like he's worked on this part of his game. It comes out in the numbers, but just the way that he's playing, he has like a calmness, he has a confidence, and in the best way, it's a lot more casual for him to be taking these shots. You want to have a player who has that muscle memory to just step into the spot, take that shot, make or miss. That's the repeatable motion. That's what Holmes looks like much more than he did in any past year. Both on, like, we're seeing it a lot more, but it's in his body language. It's in the way that he's shooting it. And yeah, it helps me to be less than just cautiously optimistic and more like subtly optimistic. I don't have to be boisterous with how much I think Holmes could be a shooter. There's a lot of ground for him to make up, but I'm not like teetering on the edge between irrational and like skeptical in that way.
Don't worry, I can be irrational enough about Holmes for the both of us. Before we move on to the next section, let's just talk quickly about the shot blocking stuff, because that, I think, you know, we've spent basically the entire podcast so far talking about the offensive elements of his game. And, you know, when talking about his versatility and the ability for Holmes to fit into multiple lineup constructions, the fact that he's such an amazing deterrent around the basket, while, you know, also having the mobility to, you know, maybe not be just a pure quote unquote five, the shot blocking is a huge element to, okay, you know, there are a lot of defenses that could use rim protection from either big man spot, right? And so him being able to do that rather than being, you know, sort of someone you have to plan around when thinking about your defense around the basket, that's another huge element that makes it easier, at least for me, to see him fitting into a lot of different NBA contexts.
Yeah, no, I really agree with that. If I were to find like any place that as I watched him as a shot blocker, I look for like places guys can improve. I think Holmes's weight is a place that maybe you'd wonder, what would he play like at a bigger weight? But in the NBA, everyone will be at a bigger weight. Outside of that, like timing, the way that he gets to his blocks, the fact that he's mean with his blocks, that's a very, you know, nebulous category. But aggression and motor is something you can see in how players attack loose balls or just how they defend the rim. He looks and takes pride in coming over for rotations. If he gets beat, he does want to get a chase down, and he doesn't get it in just one context. He's not sitting back, waiting, taking advantage of any kind of like zone rules in college. He is mobile. He shows the mobility more than other guys who might show it on one end and not the defensive end. If you have a block percentage like he does at 8.7, 6.5, and 7.2 across 3 years, it's going to be really surprising if those numbers don't bear out to actualize production. Even if they go down, you have the foundation to say he blocks shots. He can do it from like a number of different spots that you could put him in at the front court. He can be counted on to be a little bit of a deterrent at the rim.
And it's not just that, which, you know, I think there's, I agree with everything you said, but I think there's another key element here, which is, he has more blocks in his college career than fouls, right? Like when you talk about guys who have the kind of block rates that he does, a lot of the time, I mean, you know, this is unfair to multiple people, but, you know, a lot of the time when you see that, you think of a Hassan Whiteside, right? Someone who just jumps at every single shot blocking opportunity, right? Like, you know, even to be, you know, a bit kinder, someone like a Jaren Jackson Jr., who, you know, has defensive player of the year type accolades, right? But he has also had serious foul trouble throughout his NBA career because of a propensity to jump for those shots. I mean, Holmes being the kind of player that he is, and, you know, we'll get into some of the weaknesses in a moment, but being the kind of player that he is, and yet still, again, I mean, the only year of his college career that he had more fouls than blocks was last year when he had 71 fouls and 66 blocks, right? This is a guy who will reject shots, who, as you mentioned, is very competitive on the defensive end of the floor, which, you know, effort and caring about it is, you know, sort of asinine thing to bring up, but it's important. And, you know, it's something that you can clearly see from Holmes and have clearly seen from Holmes since his freshman season. But, you know, there's a difference between being a, you know, willing and able shot blocker and being a willing and able shot blocker who's also able to keep it under control enough to, you know, not jump out of his shoes and to, you know, not jump at blocks when guys can easily get around him, right? You know, that's the kind of thing where, you know, sometimes big men have to learn that at the next level, right? Holmes has that sort of built into the way that he plays.
Yeah, he doesn't have to go through like those sorts of learning curves. Even for guys that do, like you mentioned Hassan Whiteside, who was a talented defender even with the foul issues, he played a long NBA career. Guys yeah. who are having these kind of block numbers who can have that impact around the rim play for a while in the NBA. They're guys who get to a second, get to maybe a smaller but still notable third contract. And in a draft class like this, if you're looking for guys who will be a second contract player, it's really hard to find maybe a star level guy. Teams will be looking for what role players can be second contract guys. And Holmes has a number of reasons, including a shot blocking, he can get to be a second contract guy.
So just to be fair, we do have to discuss the weaknesses, the Decepticon-like details and detractions for Holmes. And the area that you start is, I completely agree with the way that you laid this out in that, you know, the two biggest areas of concern offensively, one of them I'm a lot less worried about than the other. And so let's start with one I'm a lot less worried about, which certainly seems like you are too, which is he doesn't really have much of a mid-range game. And yeah, I mean, yeah. you know, that's the kind of thing where it matters a lot more for certain players than others, just given their archetype and given the role that we would expect them to fulfill at the NBA level. And with Holmes, it's one of those things that's like, you know, it'd be nice, but it's not the end of the world if he doesn't develop the mid-range game. But, you know, if we're going to honestly evaluate his game, we have to at least point out that that's not exactly a strong suit for him.
And yes, he won't be asked to take all these shots. Other people who've worked on their game more, guys like Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, who do such great work in that mid-range. If he was on the Thunder, of course, he's not taking those touches away from Shai. He's not taking them away from Jalen Williams. It's still a nice thing to have, both as a shooting indicator. If a player is able to hit mid-range shots, you can reliably project, you know, not as much as being someone from the free throw line if they're hitting shots, but having the inside game between the arc and between the basket has its utility. If Holmes could develop maybe more of a floater off of the short roll, that would be the kind of expansion of his game that I think would have a more tangible effect than taking 5,000 mid-range jumpers in a week, because his shot diet is going to be modern. It's going to be rim. It's going to be outside. And so I agree. I don't think it's a big issue. He has a nice post fade. I think the tools are there for if he wants to do it. It would be a bit of a surprise if a team is saying, we want you taking these shots. That'd be really great for him. That'd be an amazing story of his development, but it's just a place that I don't think he'll be asked to improve on it, but it would be a place he could improve.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's that, like, if he is asked to work on his mid-range game, it means that a team really, really buys into him, which I would certainly be happy about, but, you know, it's the kind of thing where, you know, again, it's a nice to have, and, you know, as we already talked about, and as you pointed out with the free throw numbers, you know, there are signs that he's improved his touch in a way beyond just the sort of explosion from the three-point line that we've seen this year. And, you know, maybe that means that there's more for him to unlock in the mid-range game, but I doubt it's going to be an area of focus. And if it is an area of focus, it means that he's in a lot better place with his NBA future than, you know, just sort of being a role player type. But the thing that impacts him and impacts everybody, which, as you say, is, you know, maybe a more significant concern, is the turnovers. And I'm just going to quote you directly here because it's going to be better than me trying to make something up on the fly. It would be one thing if it were just an issue of poor ball handling, weakness with the ball in his hands, lackadaisical drives that resulted in charges, or poorly timed or paced passes. The bigger issue is that it's a concoction of all of the above. And that's, I think, where the problem lies. And we'll get into this in the next section in a lot more detail. But if Holmes is going to have the ball in his hands more than just purely as a play finisher, you know, again, you already talked about, you know, his ability to pass out of the post, which I think is huge, but it will be a lot easier for teams to rely on him with the ball in his hands if they're not worried about him, you know, kicking it over to the other team. And again, you know, as you mentioned, you know, it's not just a thing where it's one issue, it's a whole combination of things. And, you know, the optimistic side of me is like, okay, but a huge part of that is because all the focus is on him offensively when he has the ball in his hands for Dayton, right? And I think him not having that focus will cut down on their turnovers a bit, but you know, as you pointed out, with the issue being all of those things, it doesn't eliminate them, right? It's just, okay, he's less of a focus, so, you know, there are less defensive players, there's less defensive attention looking to try and nab the ball when he's got it in his hands. But, you know, again, as we'll get into in more depth in the next section, if you're thinking about him as someone who might have the ball in his hands more than just sort of temporarily, you know, just as in the flow of the offense, rather than, you know, him actually having maybe not plays run for him, but, you know, plays where he's more involved than just briefly touching the ball, you do need to at least be slightly more confident that he'll be able to hold on to it.
Yeah. If there's anything that's going to keep Holmes like at who he is now as a player, put a really hard cap on his ceiling. The NBA is a league that really relies on offense. And if teams know exactly where they want to put him, they don't want to see him put the ball on the floor at all, because they're worried about what kind of turnover could it be if you spin the wheel. Is it due to a handle that needs to improve? Is it due to a bit of a recklessness where he's getting charges? That's a legitimate damper on the excitement we've had. And we're excited about him because of what he's shown. He has shown that he has a bit of a propensity, as any player who has a really high usage has a propensity for turnovers. When you see a player who has a really high usage and has very few turnovers, you can count on them to create a lot of offense. The Flyers counted on him to create offense because he was really good at his scoring. He was someone who not a lot of college like athletes could match up with due to his length, his strength, and his quickness. He's only going to get to use some of those when he's in the NBA to the fullest effect. He won't get the same leash, and the leash is going to have a very clear end point. He's only going to be able to go so far until he just starts to improve the turnovers. That's not as easy as saying X, Y, or Z. It's longer into the alphabet of the places he needs to expand and really, on the other hand, cut down on his turnovers.
So let's get into the next section here, scaling up to the NBA. And we've agreed a lot about Daron Holmes so far. This section is the biggest sort of disagreement that I think we have about Holmes's game. And that is the sort of the scaling up and starting with his passing. And you say in the piece, bluntly, Holmes II will never be a Nikola Jokic or Domantas Sabonis, but that's all right. Few players are. Instead, Holmes II will likely be more of a play finisher than a creator. So, spoiler alert, bit of the sort of behind the scenes, how the sausage is made thing here. By the time all of you are listening to this, we will have released our Tuesday article, and our Tuesday article is a mock draft, and I wrote the Daron Holmes section for that mock draft. And the reason that this is sort of my biggest disagreement is I think I'm a lot more bullish on his passing future than you are. And, you know, a lot of it is the way that I've started to envision Holmes, you know, and this is sort of something that I started seeing his sophomore year, but really something that I've felt a lot more strongly with his tape this year is he's almost tailor-made, in my mind anyway, to be the backup for a Jokic or a Sabonis. I would love to have Daron Holmes II on the Kings. And the reason for that is, look, you're right. He's never going to be Nikola Jokic or Domantas Sabonis, right? But if you're talking about a backup for those guys, it's rather than DeAndre Jordan providing a completely different look in, you know, especially in the games where it looks like he's, you know, been unembalmed and just, you know, goes out there and does like Clippers DeAndre Jordan things for 10 minutes at a time. You can't run the offense through DeAndre Jordan. And he's a pretty good passing big man who I don't think has gotten enough credit for that over the course of his career, but you're not running the same sets through him. With Holmes, if you can get 70% of, you know, even less, if you can get 50% of what Jokic provides, right? Because Holmes has such a versatile all-around game, right? You can run the Domantas Sabonis. I mean, it's easier for me to talk about Sabonis because the Kings are the team that I watch more than any other by an order of magnitude, but, you know, focusing in on Sabonis, because again, I think if I continue down the Jokic lane, it's just going to get more and more of me giving caveats, but just focusing on the Sabonis side of things, right? If you're talking about handoff sets at the top of the key, when, you know, okay, the guy making the handoff is someone who can make the right read as a passer, who can, you know, isn't the best driver. Sabonis certainly isn't a perfect driver, but can and will drive to the basket with some sort of regularity. Isn't, you know, much of a mid-range shooter, but can and will occasionally pull from the top of the arc when he's got the ball in his hands. I mean, it's been less of a problem for the Kings this year, mostly because they just have different problems than they did last year. But one of the biggest problems with the team last year was the offense would just die as soon as Sabonis went to the bench, because who do you put in that spot to run those handoffs that you can, you know that the defense will at least have to key in on when he's got the ball in his hands at the top of the arc, knows that defenses will at least have to key in on when he's got the ball in his hands in the post, especially when it's a mismatch. The idea being, you know, again, you're not getting the same thing that you're getting from your all-star, all-NBA starter. Of course you aren't, but having to not have to change the entire offensive playbook every time that guy goes to the bench is huge. And, you know, I struggled with, I think it was a year and a half ago when Metcalf asked me to make a comparison for like an NBA comparison for Holmes. And it was difficult for me to get there, because I think a huge part of why I view him so highly and valuably in this draft and in previous drafts is he's almost tailor-made to be the third big man for the Nuggets or the Kings. And a huge part of that is because I am as bullish as I am on his passing talents.
I want to be where you are. I think as I watch him, I see the flashes. I think I just am a little more measured in just of what I'm seeing, because I think he shows the skills. Like, it's not like he is missing reads. It's not like he lacks the touch on passes that he would then show in shooting. When I look at more of the numerical side, and numbers tell one part of the really vivid story of a basketball player and of a prospect, I am worried about some of the passes that he does throw, because he is someone who's had the ball in his hands a lot. He knows where guys on Dayton are supposed to be cutting. He's been in that system for so long. I am a little worried about just the pace he puts on some passes, maybe some of the windows he tries to throw them into. He looks great out of the post. He can, like, one hand left or right. He can be hitting shooters on the wing. Out of the high post, he can do that too. I think for me, I do see the same ceiling of he can be in a big man rotation. If he's a starter, that means he's at a really positive career outlook. Even if he is the first or second guy off the bench, if they play a smaller lineup, but he's still getting minutes, he is someone who can keep the offense flowing. He's not going to be the hub of the offense like either the centers, Jokic, Sabonis, that we've talked about. I only wonder if his ceiling as a passer is low enough that they might, a team needs to split the difference. They won't need to completely throw the baby out with the bathwater, run different sets. I do wonder if he just is more traditional in the skills the teams will trust him with, because they worry about the turnovers. His passing skills are there, and they're a place that if he really works on them, he can bank on it and continue to just have that other piece. But that's where I at least like hold back a bit with the shooting. As I was saying, like, subtly optimistic, there's a lot more of the caution that I have in my evaluation.
And that's fair, you know, totally fair. And again, I get that I'm very much on the higher end with that sort of thing. I guess part of it as well is just that he's shown such huge developmental strides over the course of his college career that it's very easy to buy into him continuing to improve, right? And I think part of it as well is that, you know, when I say the concept of him as a third big man for those teams, part of it is because he can play alongside those guys as well, right? It's not just, okay, we have 38 minutes of Domantas Sabonis and the 10 minutes that he's on the bench, Daron Holmes is our starting center and he's running the same sets. We don't change our offense. We're not expecting it to be as effective, but at least it's not, okay, well, Domantas is out of the game. We're throwing in Alex Len or JaVale McGee because he's the backup and everything else has to be completely different. But, you know, at least with those guys, you're getting some sort of shot blocking skills that Sabonis doesn't have, right? You know, the concept that I'm sort of thinking of here is, you know, if Holmes is a 15 minute a game player for the Kings, right? He's spending, you know, let's say 10 of those minutes as Sabonis' backup and 5 of those minutes with Sabonis. And, you know, in that sense, a lot of the sort of complementary skills that we've already talked about come into play more, right? Like, Nikola Jokic has improved drastically as a defender since his first years in the NBA, but he's not the same kind of shot blocking presence that Daron Holmes is by any stretch of the imagination. And so, okay, you know, he plays alongside him for 5 minutes. He is the primary center for 10 minutes or however that sort of breakdown works out. But, you know, part of my sort of optimism with it is, look, until he gets better with the turnovers, which, you know, I definitely agree is an issue for him and, you know, is really the only damper that I'm, you know, putting on his passing skill set, acknowledging that I'm being way optimistic about where it is and where it can be. You know, I think the idea is if you draft him to do that and you end up being closer to right than I am, and the passing is not as far along as I would like to be, and the turnovers are more of an issue than, you know, I would have liked to believe, he can at least play alongside those guys as well, right? But I think part of the reason I'm so bullish on him is the idea that he can do all of these things, right? He can, and, you know, maybe he goes to a team that doesn't want to have him be the hub of the offense at all, that just wants him to be a play finisher, as you mentioned. You know, guess what? He was, you know, it's a bit down this year, but his freshman year, he was one of the best transition players in college basketball. You know, he's a great role man. He sets good screens. You know, there are other areas where he'll earn his NBA playing time. I guess my sort of take on it is just that he shows enough flashes that, you know, I can buy into him being that sort of, you know, it's funny, I should have thought of this when Metcalf asked me a year and a half ago, but, you know, more of a Dario Saric type where there's a lot that he can do and some teams will use some of it and other teams will use others of it. But if he can come through on all of it, then that's really a perfect sort of situation for him as that guy who can be your, all right, you know, our star starting center's out of the game. Let's find a way that the offense cannot grind to a halt when we've got to send Sabonis to the bench for those 10 minutes a game.
And even when, for example, Sabonis, even when Jokic would be on the bench, rarely do you see an all-bench lineup in the NBA.
Yes.
You're a bench player. You're still playing with a configuration of the starters. In those starters, you rarely have a coach say, line shift, hockey style, no primary creator that we are starting the game with. So it wouldn't be that Holmes would be expected to completely step into the shoes of these players either. That would only happen if you're as injured as the Memphis Grizzlies or you're have a record like the Memphis Grizzlies this year. It would be where it's an extreme situation. And so I see where you're going with Holmes' potential. I mean, for a team, the Kings, the Nuggets, teams that have a weakness at the backup big spot because their strength is the starting big spot, I think Holmes would do a really great job. We might just be on slightly different levels of the confidence and optimism that even if Holmes like breaks even on what we're thinking, that's still a really good backup big. And so I see where you're going. I see where I am and I see the vision.
So let's get into an area where I think we're a lot more on the same page with sort of where some of the issues might come in. And that's, you know, on the defensive side. And, you know, what you mentioned in the piece, you know, about sort of how he was mostly doing drop at Dayton, right? That's the kind of thing where, you know, okay, that's kind of what you would expect. But as you say in the piece, if he wants to be a consistent starter, he's got to be more than just a solid drop defender. And that's, I think, where, you know, again, I'm extraordinarily optimistic about Holmes. If you couldn't tell by this point in the podcast, you're probably listening to us on mute, which why would you do that with a podcast? But the defensive stuff is, I think, a lot more of a concern for me when it comes to ceiling stuff than it is the offensive stuff. Because if he's going to be this player that I'm envisioning on the most optimistic side, he's going to need to be more than just a drop guy. He's going to need to be able to switch out on the perimeter to play with a Jokic or play with a Sabonis. And again, you know, it's funny because, you know, you even said earlier, and I agree with you, that unlike a lot of players, he shows some of the same, you know, mobility and effort on the defensive end as the offensive end, which again, you can't say about everybody. But, you know, the flip side is, you know, again, as you mentioned, a lot of the sort of perimeter stuff with him looks shakier than you might expect. And that even I, a relentless Holmes optimist, am a little bit more concerned about, certainly than the passing stuff, but, you know, really more than anything besides the turnovers is, okay, if he's purely a drop guy, I think he has a lot of value as a rotation player. But as we'll get into in just a moment with the projections for him, he's not going to be more than that if he's someone who you're worried about defending on the perimeter.
Exactly. I don't think that Holmes is like a terrible perimeter defender. he's not someone who's going to routinely just be called to get switched in something like a playoff setting in a must-win game. And by that same token, he is not the caliber of interior defender that you would be okay with him just playing drop and getting to play 30 minutes a game. He's a good shot blocker. I mentioned it earlier. I think he can put on a bit more like weight to be able to withstand like drives, some like finishes on the inside, even though the numbers might say otherwise. I think eye test just, it looks like he's a little bit skinny when he's getting up to that next level. With his defense and space, the game is only going to get faster. The players are only going to get better. He's going to need to get better. And it's not that I'm sort of putting the nail in any coffin on it, but I do wonder where it can come. He has a bit of a high center of gravity for if he's going to be defending out there just based on his proportions. His foot speed is good, but is it good enough that he can, you know, be going back and forth, keeping in front of a guy? I do wonder where is it going to come for his perimeter defense to see some improvement. He doesn't have to be great. He's not going to be Bam. He's not going to be Draymond, who can just be the skeleton key on the defense. He needs to have a few more just like reliable ways that he cannot get blown by the best basketball athletes in the world to be more than that rotation big. Rotation big is a great role. Both of us as believers think he can be more. This is one of the places that would hold him back from being more.
Yeah, and we'll get into the sort of potential for more in just a moment, but I do want to stick with this point because I think it's critical. I mean, we've been talking the entire time about him as a rotation big man, right? And I think that's the key is, you know, again, there's been a long sort of transformation of from tweener being sort of a death knell for a prospect to, you know, it being almost in vogue for a little bit, but also the sort of concept of a tweener used to be more of a 3-4 thing, and it's become a lot more of a 4-5 thing. And that's, I think, the problem for Holmes is if he can't defend at least adequately on the perimeter, he's a lot more locked in as a 5, right? He basically has to be your, you know, I was talking about the 4-out-1-in on offense, but, you know, similar on defense, right? And I'm a lot more comfortable with his ability to not just be purely the in guy on offense than on defense. And that's where I think the concerns come in. I mean, he makes up for his height a lot with his leaping ability, with his mobility, but this is still a guy who's 6'10", 220, which is, you know, again, a lot more sort of traditional, quote unquote, power forward size than center size. And so if he's going to be able to get the minutes at the four that I think he will need to unlock the best of what he can be at the NBA level, he's going to need to be better on the perimeter. And it's the kind of thing where, you know, again, yeah, he's not anywhere close to a Draymond or even a Toumani Kamara, right? His former teammate in terms of his foot speed and switchability. But, you know, he doesn't need to be that. He just needs to be adequate to the point where, okay, you know, if he gets switched on to, you know, a Ja Morant, he's probably going to get cooked, right? But, you know, if he gets switched on to a wing and can adequately keep up with the guy for long enough to, you know, either switch back or even to end the possession on him, you're talking about a lot higher of a ceiling than, okay, this guy's essentially locked in as our backup five and only our backup five if we're a team that likes to run small, which, you know, a lot of the teams that we've talked about, that's, you know, a position that they would fill, right? I mean, if Trey Lyles has spent a lot of minutes at center for the Kings, which less this year than last year, but, you know, if he's someone who you're throwing out there as a small ball five, Daron Holmes is big enough to be that small ball five, right? But if you're talking about him being more than, you know, sort of a bit player at the end of the bench, a lot of it is going to come down to the elements we've talked about of how can he be as someone who could potentially have offense run through him, which, you know, again, we've already talked about our differing levels of optimism about that. And then, you know, how long can you really afford to have him out there as a perimeter guy in a switch system? And the answer is, I think, going to be a huge part of determining his NBA ceiling.
Yeah, there's been so much development that I'm definitely not closing the door on what he will be able to do as a switch defender. Doing so would be foolish. Like, he would send my like attempt there into the stands based on what he's done before. I think that the places he needs to improve to to go from backup to real rotation, real being not a starter, but being like a game ender. These are micro skills that separate the people who can improve, the prospects who can put in the work and have that dedication, from those who are worthy NBA players who never make that like small leap for prospect kind, massive leap for their NBA career.
So we've talked about it a lot throughout and a lot sort of now, but before we wrap up, let's just sort of fully dive into the projection and the last section of the article titled Prospect in Disguise, Who Holmes Can Be. And this is, I think, you know, again, I tried to temper my optimism in some places. This is the part where I'm not going to temper my optimism because, you know, first of all, I mean, that's part of the fun, right? Of like, hey, how good can this guy be, right? But, you know, I think the idea there being, and I've written a lot of the blurbs that we've had for Holmes on various mock drafts throughout the years, literally at this point for No Ceilings, but I think ultimately where I stand on it is he has such a versatile skill set that he's got a very high floor. I mean, again, you know, I'm talking about, you know, if his ideal sort of context for where he is right now as a player, in my mind anyway, is as the third big man for a team like the Nuggets or the Kings, or to a lesser extent, the Heat, just because Bam Adebayo is a defender that Domantas Sabonis and Nikola Jokic will never reach. But, you know, that sort of concept of him, you know, that's very reliant on the fact that, you know, pretty much anything you could ask of for a backup big, he's shown somewhere between some and very high capacity to fill those roles. Right. And so when you're talking about that, it's like, all right, you know, what team couldn't use at least some of the skills that Daron Holmes II brings to the table in their rotation? And that answer becomes very small. But if we're talking about upside, it's an entirely different thing. But we could at least start with the floor of like, look, even if you're more pessimistic about a whole lot of his skills, there's stuff that he does that's pretty much undeniable. I mean, his block numbers, his dunks, his ability as a role man, his ability in transition, right? Pretty much every team could use those. And those parts of his skill set are pretty much, I don't want to say entirely undeniable because there's always someone who's going to deny something. But, you know, the idea being a lot of the talk about Holmes is there's very little that he can't at least do to some level, which makes it very easy to see how high the floor is.
Yeah. In a draft that has a lot of questions too, even if you're talking about like when a player is going the late 20s, it's often said, oh, this team doesn't have a lot of holes. They just need to fill a few last places. Holmes can fill the last few holes that teams would have really well. So if a team needs a backup big who does the dirty work, who can make the interior a real like strength when they don't have a starter on the floor, that's very easy first round value. That's very easy even for myself, and I believe for you, like top 20 value in a draft where having a high floor is rarer than having like a high ceiling combined with a low floor. It's not an insult to say we can see the role for Holmes at his worst, because that role is still an NBA.
It's funny because the thought running through my mind right now is of someone who I have very close on my personal board to Daron Holmes for almost diametrically opposite reasons, who we've talked about before in Isaiah Collier, right? And with Collier, you know, again, there are some things that I think Collier will be able to reliably do at an NBA level, right? Like his driving, as we talked about on that episode, you know, very, very close to being the elite of the elite in college basketball, if not there, right? But with Collier, there's a whole lot more of, man, if he can't shoot, it's going to be a lot harder to find a place for him. You know, man, if he can't work on the turnovers, that's even more of an issue for him than it is for Holmes because of the role that he'll be projected to play at the next level. You know, with Collier, it's so much more of a lottery ticket if you're taking him at, say, 17, you know, just randomly picking a place in the top 20 outside the lottery, right? If your front office is discussing Collier or Holmes at that spot, it's for drastically different reasons. But in this draft in particular, I mean, I've said before that over time, I've gotten more and more into the mold of if you're picking in the 20s, just pick someone who you know can play unless, you know, XYZ caveats, because vast majority of the time teams picking in the 20s they don't need another superstar. They just need a rotation player who can make them from a mid-tier playoff team to a top-tier playoff team, right? You know, again, there's always trading picks, et cetera, et cetera. You know, some teams end up, you know, lower in the draft order than their record would suggest. And so maybe they need to take that swing. I get that concept. But if you're a team picking at 21, right? I mean, you know, the Nuggets are going to be a lot higher. The Kings don't have a first round pick this year because of trades. But, you know, if you are a team in that sort of range, you know, what do you need more? Do you need someone who 3 years from now can be your superstar? Or do you need someone who can take you over the top as a bit player in your rotation? It's a lot easier for me to feel comfortable with Daron Holmes filling an NBA role than it is for Isaiah Collier. And the ceilings are going to be different, but of course they are, because if you had the same ceiling but a much higher floor, we're not talking about you in the mid-20s or the early 20s, right? You know, we're talking about you in the lottery. And again, you know, it's a very different sort of discussion, but especially in this year's draft with so many questions, if you can emerge with someone who will be a valuable role player for your team, as you mentioned, into the second, maybe even into the third contract, you know, there are going to be a lot of teams who need that swing more than the teams who are like, we just desperately need a second superstar. I guess we'll take the chance on Isaiah Collier.
Yeah. We are also talking about what are on like the lower ends of Holmes' NBA outcomes.
Saving the higher end until I'd at least clarified my takes before I go completely insane.
No, and like that sort of like insanity is like why I wanted to write about him. I see the outline of someone who can be hitting shots from deep. That demands like a lot more minutes per game. That demands attention. It at times demands a starting spot, whether it's, hey, we like this matchup, or it's, hey, we cannot keep you off the floor based on all the good things you do for a team. For a team to be able to maybe grab a starter in that 20-some pick range, what I would feel maybe is the safe range where Holmes will be looking after all is said and done, that is something that is really valuable. Those are the moves that is not just going from like a middle-of-the-road playoff team to a contender. That's something that keeps a contender around for a few more years. That's something that keeps you as a perennial playoff team. That's something that for Holmes makes him not just like worry about a second contract. It's allowing him to say, what team gives me the role to let me shoot, to let me just block the heck out of a shot, to let me dunk the heck out of every attempt I have close. And I see that silhouette, and it becomes clearer, especially this year, the more that I watched him, of being like a starting caliber NBA big.
So let's get into that starting caliber discussion now. And now, you know, again, ha ha ha, no ceiling, so let's not talk about the ceiling on a prospect, blah, blah, blah. You know, any of that, whatever terrible puns you want to make on my behalf that I'm teasing at. But I mean, this is still the pinned piece on my Twitter profile of a piece I wrote a couple years ago, which was just essentially why I love writing about the draft. And the main reason for me is hope. It's, you know, that's the easiest way I can distill it down of, man, you know, what if this guy figures out this? What if this incredible shot creator takes a few more of the terrible shots out of their shot diet so we can see the best of what they can be? What if this guy who has incredible athletic tools but hasn't quite figured it out on the defensive end yet, what if he does start to put things together and be the best that he can be? What if this guy who's an everything but the shot guy does in fact figure out the shot and then, you know, allows everything else to shine through? And with Holmes, you know, basically every time I've written a blurb about him, you know, I've essentially said, look, all of this is, he's so tailor-made to be the backup or a rotation big man for so many teams that it's easy to see that part of it. And it's a lot harder to disagree with that concept. The flip side is he is a completely different player than he was his freshman year. And I loved him as a prospect his freshman year, right? But he has taken such dramatic developmental strides forward. And more than that, as you mentioned earlier on in the episode that, you know, I thought was exactly on point, is he's shown key developmental areas in clear areas where he needed to show development, right? I mean, him becoming a shooter, it's not just him becoming a shooter, right? It's him perfecting being a spot up guy who can spot up out of pick and pop situations and be a threat who defenses have to pay attention to. He's not, you know, trying to work out his Trey Mann, you know, kind of, you know, 17 dribbles into a step back game, right? And I love Trey Mann in his class, so that's not a knock on him at all. The idea here being Holmes has shown clear improvement in the ways where he needed to improve to round out his game. And he's gotten to this point where any sort of conception you have for what you need for your backup big man, he's shown that he can fill some of those gaps. Now the question becomes, okay, but there's no reason to assume that he's done developing. And then the question is, where do we go from here? And the idea of him becoming a starter is something that, you know, when I was evaluating him, you know, very early on in his sophomore year, when I wrote about him last year, a lot of it was, man, he does so many of these, you know, complimentary backup things well. He's so good as a cutter. He's such an excellent transition player. And hey, on those rare chances when he's forced to post a guy up, he can take advantage. So if there's a switch situation, he can bully someone if they stick a guard on him. But if you're talking about the upside for Holmes, I mean, you know, the defensive stuff, you know, he's shown the athletic tools to at least be able to figure out more of the perimeter defense stuff than he has. But, you know, a lot of what I talked about then was, man, this guy's such a great fit as a role player. And then he became the hub of the offense, right? And it wasn't perfect by any stretch. And certainly, as I mentioned earlier, I think for some people's evaluation of Holmes, it's sort of distracted from, look, he's got such a high baseline as a complimentary guy that if all you're focused on is how much he posts up, you're going to miss everything else. The flip side of that is, wait, what if he actually is good enough to do that at an NBA level? And then that becomes a lot more fun of a discussion where we're not just talking about him as a backup, but we're talking about him as someone who can start and can be a huge part of a team's offense. And, you know, again, I don't want to go too overboard in the optimism and say that he's anywhere close right now, but he has the baseline to do, you know, pretty much anything you would want from a starting center. There are areas where he needs to improve to get to that point, but we've shown he has shown a clear developmental trend line of, look, this is where I need to shore up my game. Okay, great. I'm going to work on that. And, you know, it was going from, look, when I wrote about him, like, what, a year and a half ago at this point, he was a non-shooter. Now he is very much not a non-shooter. And so then the question becomes, what's next? Because, again, you know, it's not like he's going to stop working on his game when he gets to the NBA, right? It's just a matter of, is there an avenue for him to be more than a backup for a team? And I think there is. And if he ends up in the right situation, you know, it goes from, oh man, he was, you know, a really good get at 18. You know, he's come in and immediately filled 15 minutes a game for us. You know, that's one thing of, okay, you know, nice. We hit on a prospect outside the lottery, right? But there is an avenue for Holmes where there isn't necessarily for some other big men to, no, actually, I can have offense run through me. I can be more than just a backup for a Sabonis or a Jokic. I can be someone that you can rely on. And when you're talking about that, you're talking about someone who should be much closer to the top of this draft than he's going to end up actually getting drafted.
Yeah, for all the talk of, oh, this is a draft without star power. Maybe it is in terms of like the guys you see right away. Every draft, there's an average of however many, 2, 3, 4 all-star caliber players. We can't see who they are right now more than in other years. It could be in some worlds. It would require a lot of development, things he's shown that he can do. But Holmes, if he can hit threes at a really high clip, if he starts to put the ball on the floor, if he can be just like a guy who can play drop in that way, you start to wonder, you know, this year, Naz Reid looks like he's on the way to winning Sixth Man of the Year. And Naz Reid has improved his game for where it was at LSU, what he can do putting the ball on the floor. I see, it's not a perfect comparison, but I see echoes between those two. That's a really great outcome because Naz Reid has been a big part of the success for the Timberwolves in one of their best seasons. That would be a really great outcome for Holmes, where even if he's not a starter, he's one of the best backup bigs in the league who makes a difference. And that's something that I can see him eventually getting to because of, even without it being linear, because of the trajectory he's shown and just, you know, the passing flashes, maybe that flash is even brighter. There are a lot of places he can improve, to be more than he is right now. What he is right now is pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, you say in the piece explicitly, you can't teach Holmes a second's height, athleticism, or touch, right? And it's the kind of thing when, you know, normally, and again, you know, I'm making broad strokes here purely for the purpose of edifying the point I'm about to make, but, you know, a lot of the times when you're talking about these really high floor players, you know, it's not guys who can jump like Holmes can, right? It's not guys who can block shots like Holmes can. Most of the time it's like, wow, this guy really reads the game exceptionally well, and he knows where he's supposed to be, and he's always there, and he can shoot, and he doesn't turn the, you know, all those sorts of things. And a lot of those apply to Holmes, and a lot of those are why we think of him as such a high floor prospect. But, you know, again, this is going too far, but again, I'm only going too far to edify the point, right? Like, the last time I can remember a draft class being talked about in similar veins to this one was 2013. And look, I mean, I thought at the time that it was ludicrous that there was all this discussion at the top of that draft, because I thought it should have been Victor Oladipo at number one pretty clearly, and it wasn't. And I think, you know, despite Oladipo's horrendous injury history, I think history has proved out that he was the guy who should have been at the top of that class, but he wasn't the best player in that class, because the best player in that class went 15th. Giannis Antetokounmpo. And look, you know, that's the obvious, like, okay, are you seriously comparing Deron Holmes to Giannis Antetokounmpo? No, I'm not. I want to be very clear. I'm not comparing the two of them. But the concept, I think, is very important to think about with this year's draft of, okay, maybe there isn't an obvious, abundant superstar who, like, okay, Wembanyama is at the top of the draft class. We know who's going number one, right? That doesn't necessarily mean that there aren't going to be all-stars from this class, because even the worst draft class of all time by orders of magnitude, the 2000 draft, produced three all-stars and an all-NBA guy. And if Michael Redd hadn't gotten hurt, probably would have been a lot more, just purely for Michael Redd. And honestly, if Kenyon Martin hadn't gotten hurt, probably he would have made more than one all-star team, right? But that's the absolute basement, basically all time for absolute worst draft class that anybody can think of. And if this year ends up like that, which I think this draft class is a lot deeper than that draft class was. And, you know, I was seven at the time. I wasn't exactly following the draft religiously, but the concept here is, look, there's going to be someone from this year's draft class who ends up being a lot better in the NBA than people thought they were going to be. And there's going to be a whole lot of, why didn't this guy go higher? Why didn't that guy go higher? And, you know, if you could prognosticate that, you would be the richest GM in professional basketball. But the whole idea of, oh, this is a terrible draft, this is a terrible draft, there are a lot of guys in this class. You know, I think even the people who are most out on this draft would agree that there are a lot of guys who can be valuable role players and contribute to a team. And Holmes is one of those guys. And then the question becomes, what more can we get? What more can we see? And with Holmes, you know, again, he has a lot of these sort of intangibles that you can't teach, not only physically, but also mentally, right? How many prospects with impeccable athletic tools do we look at and say, God, I wish you tried on defense? Holmes is not that, right? And, you know, a lot of prospects who, man, you know, I don't know how much work you're putting in the gym, but it really feels like your game is stagnated. I wish you were doing X, Y, and Z to continue to improve as a player. That's not a problem that Holmes has either. And so, if you're thinking about the kind of player who you can look back and say, man, why didn't he go higher? He's got all these things he can do so well. And, you know, he figured X, Y, and Z out at the NBA level and all of a sudden became a much better player than people were expecting. I mean, Holmes is near the top of that list for me. And then it becomes a question of, you know, yeah, I have to temper expectations. You know, again, referring to that piece that I mentioned earlier, you know, there was an element to which I said, look, I have to try and be honest. I can't be full hope all the time. I can't be 99th percentile outcome all the time, because, you know, that's when you slip and fall, right? But the idea being here, and I promise I'm almost at the end of my little rant, but Holmes has such a high floor, but also has shown such intriguing flashes in such key areas and such developmental leaps forward in such key areas that even if I wanted to, I can't rule out the notion that he makes just a few more little minor tweaks to the areas that are a problem. And all of a sudden, we're not talking about him as a valuable rotation player. We're talking about him as someone who could be a long-term NBA starter.
It's easier to hope this way when even if he falls short of like what we would really what we can kind of see from him, we'd be really excited to see from him if he reaches it. If he falls short, he's still playing NBA minutes. Yeah. They're not just having a scratch-off lottery-type boom or bust. He's not a boom or bust. He's like a boom or like really just, I wish I had another B word that fit in there. he's going to be like, his baseline is still good. His baseline is still NBA quality. I think there are more scenarios that maybe people have taken into account where even if it's a minor boom, he booms and has a really important role and creates a space for himself that's more than you'd expect out of a big man selected in the 20s.
This is terrible, but I'm going to go for it anyway. Boom or balanced. Either he's going to boom or he's going to be somewhere like the 50th percentile outcome for him is, you know, still valuable bench player. Like the 25th percentile outcome for him, I think, is end of the bench for a few years, maybe makes it to a second contract, but not guaranteed, right? You know, I don't want to rag on the guy because, again, I think you and I have been holdouts on him for a long time. But just going back to our discussion of Isaiah Collier, right? It's very easy to see a world in which Isaiah Collier does not have a long-term NBA career. It is a lot harder for me to see a world in which Daron Holmes does not have at least some sort of an NBA career. And look, the ceiling for Isaiah Collier is best player in the draft class. Even I, like the most optimistic Holmes believer outside of maybe his parents, you know, like I don't see that kind of outcome for him as being the best player in this draft class. But, you know, I almost feel crazy saying this, but I'm going to say it anyway, because, you know, if anyone's not going to laugh at me for this, it might be you. Is it entirely out of the question that he is, you know, a step below Domantas Sabonis and earns one All-Star selection during his career? I don't think it's entirely impossible. We've seen him run an offense at Dayton, and I don't think he's ever going to run an NBA offense. But, you know, if Holmes puts together an 18-10, 2.5 block season with really efficient shooting and 3 assists per game against, you know, 2 turnovers or something relatively minimal, you know, I mean, I talked about the 2000 draft. That's a better season than Jamal McGlure had when he was an All-Star, right? Like, it's not impossible for me to see. And even if that's like 99.9th percentile outcome, I think the percentage threshold for him becoming a solid starter is a lot lower than 99th percentile. I think it's the kind of thing where if he ends up in the right situation with a team that can, you know, have him play significant developmental minutes while also bringing along the areas of his game that need bringing along, not only do I think it's out of the question for him to become a starter, but I think it's significantly more likely than a lot of the players I group in the same sort of category of he's going to be really valuable in someone's rotation, but do I see the ceiling for him to be a starter? Probably not.
Yeah, look, whether he gets to that really high ceiling that I can see him in some universes getting there, I don't think you and I don't think I am going to be the one that bets against that happening, that completely shuts the door. I've seen too much. I've like analyzed too much. It's out there. It would be really exciting. We would get to tip our caps, but he'd get to tip his cap the most because he has put in the work and it's there in his game. If he fully taps into the places he needs to, that season is not just a pipe dream. I think that whether that happens, I mean, that's the excitement. We'll see it on draft night where he goes. We'll see it in his years in the NBA. We'll be following maybe closer than 99.9% of fans of the NBA, but I think it's really worth looking at for a player like Holmes.
I don't think we could end on a better point than that, but anything else you want to cover here before we wrap this one up?
Sounds good on my end as well.
All right. Well, he is Rowan Kent. You can find him at Rowan Kent on Twitter, and you can, of course, find his written work on NoCeilingsNBA.com. You can find me on Twitter at NBA Johnson, and you can, of course, find my written work on NoCeilingsNBA.com as well. If you've been enjoying the show, please take the time to leave a rating and or a review in whatever podcast player you might be using. That is always much appreciated on our end. And, of course, subscribe to the No Ceilings NBA Draft Podcast if you have not already. And if you have any feedback regarding the deep dive specific portion of the podcast, I admittedly have been a bit inconsistent over the past couple months just because I was very sick in January and February, which did not help. But hopefully I will be a lot more consistent for the remainder of the year, and would love to hear from any and all of you who have feedback. So if you have any feedback on the deep dive specific portion, again, feel free to reach out to me either via Twitter or email nickaj.nba@gmail.com. And as always, thanks so much for listening.